As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Yo. Technology. What is it all about?
You're going to have five AI systems that give you answers, that produce video, that produce art, that produce writing. And I think we have a real fork in the road between this kind of world of these five internet services and kind of nothing else, or a diverse, rich, interesting, decentralized internet. And my argument is a lot of it comes down to how we build these internet services.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in tech. I'm your host, Danny Fortson, the West Coast correspondent for the Sunday Times. And this week, appropriately, we're talking about crypto. You will have seen, of course, that Bitcoin is back, baby. It hit a new record this week of $69,200. And of course, you will recall that just 2 years ago, the price collapsed. The whole industry went into a deep freeze. More than $2 trillion of quote-unquote value was destroyed. Scammers came out of the woodwork from FTX to Celsius. It was a disaster of truly epic proportions. And all the skeptics, understandably, took a victory lap. Here was the comeuppance for this thing, which, I'll be honest, I still don't totally understand. And I have written tens of thousands of words about crypto, talked to the smartest people in the world about it, and yet it remains this kind of a little bit of a mystery to me. What is it for? What problem does it actually solve? And why 16 years since the original Bitcoin white paper have we yet to find the kind of the killer app for crypto? So the true believers might say, well, Bitcoin already is a killer app. If you go back 10 years, Bitcoin was worth $600. So today's price is 100 times what it was then. And over time, despite the wild gyrations, the price has generally trended upwards. So perhaps it is digital gold, as a lot of people like to say, you know, the store of value that is made for the modern era. Or maybe it's just rat poison squared, as Warren Buffett has famously called it. In any event, as we emerge from this latest crypto winter, as prices recover, new optimism emerges that crypto is not, in fact, dead, and it's not this wasteland of grifters. We have on today's show perhaps the single most important investor in this world. Chris Dixon is the head of Andreessen Horowitz's $7.6 billion crypto funds. He has invested in well over 100 companies in this industry. He spends a lot of time in Washington talking to lawmakers about regulation, and he's also written a book called Read, Write, Own, in which he places crypto in the wider context of technology and specifically the internet. And his thesis is basically that the web has gone astray, that this thing that was supposed to unleash a billion voices and seed all kinds of exciting new businesses has basically been grabbed hold of by five companies. And in his narrative, crypto, which is decentralized, controlled by no one, ruled by software code, not rapacious companies or executives, is the antidote. It's the key to delivering on the internet's original promise. Skeptical? Well, I'll admit, I am too. But for the next hour, Chris and I have a really great conversation about the present and future of crypto and why he remains optimistic despite the drama of the last few years. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this one, so I'm just going to hand you over now to my conversation with Chris Dixon of Andreessen Horowitz. Enjoy. You've been doing the rounds for the book, and I as a tech journalist, there was a time when all I wrote about was crypto. Now, all I write about is AI.
You'll be writing about crypto again soon, I think.
Yeah. Well, I've been seeing all of a sudden things are coming roaring back pretty dramatically.
Suddenly, I'm getting all these friends who disappeared for 3 years showing back up. So we'll see.
So can we just start with the basic question? Why write a book about this thing that you've been doing for the past decade plus?
As you said, I've been doing it for a long time. And I, as part of that, speak to a bunch of folks, including people who aren't in the technology business. I spent a lot of time lately on policy, and I've been going to DC and London and other places. And literally every meeting, somebody at the end of the meeting says, what book should I read, first of all? So they say, build the product that you want.
Yeah.
And a little bit in that spirit, I thought we just need a book on this. There's some great books on like Bitcoin and other history books on like Coinbase and other companies. But I didn't think there was a book that kind of comprehensively laid out the positive productive use of blockchains for the general reader. So that's what I want it to be. And to explain it in the context of internet history and specifically answer the question, unfortunately, we've seen the dark side of blockchains with FTX and the other scandals, which everyone's quite aware of. And I think for some people that has led them to believe that there's not a productive and positive side of it. And so I wanted to lay out the case for the positive side, because my general view is that every technology can be used right and wrong. You know, you can use a hammer to destroy a house or to build a house, nuclear energy, AI can be used in good and bad ways. And same with blockchains. And the ideal policy kind of regulatory approach in my mind is one that tries to minimize the bad and maximize the good. But a precondition of that is understanding what the good is, right? So I really want to just sort of make that case. And so the book, you know, it tries very hard to avoid jargon that's not defined. I really try to explain things and show how it works and not make claims that aren't justified. My feeling is that going through the history of the internet was important because, as the title implies, I see the internet in the three, read, write, own refers to three eras of the internet. It's why I got into this business. I joined the internet in the late 90s, early 2000s, the internet business. And I was inspired by the promise of the internet as a decentralized network where any entrepreneur or creative person could create a website and an internet presence and build an audience and build a business. And I think that a lot of great things have happened over the course of the last, you know, 20 plus years on the internet, including getting internet access to 5 billion people. You can get online for $10 now. A lot of positive things. But I think in that process, we handed over control to essentially five companies, Facebook, Apple, Google, et cetera. And so to me, the potential value of blockchains is that you can, and my kind of core argument in the book, is that you can create a new wave of internet services that embody the early ideals of the internet, but also allow you to create the advanced services that we've come to expect and love from modern internet services. So that's kind of the core thesis and why this matters. And I think specifically, you know, like AI is a very exciting technology. Our firm is doing a lot of investing there. I think, though, that left unchecked, it will also further reinforce the centralization of the internet. Yeah. I believe this is a very timely kind of question and an important technology at the moment.
Well, to your point around AI, I was just reading right before we got on Elon Musk's lawsuit against OpenAI, which he filed last night. We're speaking on Friday. He filed it last night, and his whole argument is like the whole point of OpenAI was to not have this very powerful technology centralized in the hands of one company, effectively Google in this case, and seems very angry that this is how it's gone. Now you have this AI, very powerful AI in OpenAI, now controlled by Microsoft through its basically sponsorship of this thing. But I guess this idea of the centrally controlled technologies, and it sounds like what you're saying is blockchain is the kind of a potential antidote.
I think blockchain is one. I think open source AI is a separate topic, but I think it's also an important antidote. I mentioned how you can get a phone for $10. Why is it so cheap to get on the internet? Because almost all the software that you use is free.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Android phones are Linux. It's a, you know, open source software operating system. All of the server side software, almost all of it that uses AWS and things is free. I talk a lot about open source in my book. Open source, I think, is one of the underrated triumphs of modern technology and has been a great democratizing force, a great deflationary force We used to talk in the 90s about the digital divide and how can we make internet accessible. I think open source is really the reason that it is so accessible. I think with AI, the same question is AI going to be this luxury good or this thing that only big companies can access? Or if consumers access it, they have to give up all their data and control and all these other things? Or is it going to be democratically controlled? Is it everyone right. going to have access to it? And I think that's a critical question. We've gotten as a firm involved in sort of policy questions, and our two big issues are blockchains, which we think are important for creating open democratic internet services, and then open source AI, which, you know, which is important for making sure that the software layer is also democratically controlled.
So my question is then, so we're in, it's 2008, we have the Bitcoin white paper, and then we have these various kind of spasms of enthusiasm. Bitcoin goes yeah. from X to X times 100 to X times 100 again, falls back down, et cetera. But we're now 16 years removed from that kernel of an idea starting something. And what I find interesting, and you point this out in the book, which I don't think a lot of people realize, is, you know, AI feels like all of a sudden it's arrived. Like it's this thing that just showed up. And everybody's like, oh my God, this thing is amazing. And what's interesting about this AI moment is that it's very quickly and obviously useful in lots of different ways. Like it just works in these really surprising, powerful ways, to putting aside all the problems with it. The thing about blockchain, which I struggle with, and which is why whenever you say those two words, people's eyes glaze over and they're like, what is that? Is that it's not obvious, right? It's because it's this kind of obscure architecture. And then you can talk about Bitcoin, which is a kind of a different thing. So I guess my question is like, where are we in that? Because I was looking before we got on, you've invested in more than 100 companies. At least that are in the current portfolio, all in some kind of part of this universe. But where is it? Because it feels like part of it is like, well, it's just beginning. And part of it's like, we're a decade and a half plus into this. And like, I still don't get it. And I still don't see the value of it. And I still don't see the quote unquote killer app. And it's confusing.
Yeah, I mean, so the first point, as you alluded to, is that I think there's a lot of revisionism around how long it took existing technologies to develop. So the first neural network paper was 1943, 80 years, McCulloch and Pitts, 80 years before ChatGPT. There was actually, if you go on Wikipedia, you can look up, there was a 1980s AI bubble, actually, believe it or not. There were many waves of AI. I actually personally started a machine learning AI company in 2008. I thought it was finally going to happen.
Old school.
Yeah, I know. And I was 15 years too early. So there you go. I mean, maybe that's why I found that the timing in these things is very hard. And I got that one wrong. You know, there's a great documentary on General Magic. It was a company that tried to create something like an iPhone in 1993, so 14 yeah. years before the iPhone. Internet, go look up CompuServe, Prodigy. These were big AOL. These were 1980s internet them. Services. The yep. internet goes back to the 60s, actually. So number one, these things just do sometimes take some time. I think specifically with blockchains, look, we had Bitcoin in 2008, but then really Ethereum in 2015 took the ideas of Bitcoin and said, let's generalize them and think of Ethereum as creating an app store. Now anyone can yeah. build an app on top. So in some ways, I see 2015 as like kind of the proper, I mean, that's when I got fully engaged with it, is I was like, oh, wow, this is a computer. You can build apps for it. And then I would say, if you're inside it like me, then what happened is, okay, it was a computer, but it wasn't that great of a computer. And so there was a lot of work kind of making it more performant. So then 6 years later, 2021, things were going well. And then I would argue what happened is we had this kind of catastrophic setback because a bunch of scammers, including yeah. FTX, got involved. And I think that just bumped everything back a couple of years at least. And so that's how I see the history of it, sort of like the proper modern history, 2015, things are getting better. We're now building apps that are starting to go mainstream, NFTs, DeFi, stable coins. Like there were a bunch of interesting things happening 2021, 2022, but then you just had this boom. And look, and consumers were obviously hurt and they were the main victims, but it also had the secondary effect of just, as you say, like just really damaging the brand. And the thing I'll also say is like blockchains they're fundamentally social technologies. So you go to ChatGPT and it's single player, as I call it in the book, right? Whereas an NFT or a digital currency has no use if you're all alone. It's about sharing it with somebody else and creating a network. You're never going to have the sort of, I go to a website and have this thing happen, because it's not what it is. In the book, I compare it to steel versus wood. It's like a new building material for building better internet services. It's not in and of, you're not in and of itself. You're not going to go to a blockchain and ask it a question the way you do ChatGPT. It's an infrastructure. And that was one of the challenges in writing the book, is writing about infrastructure is like not an obviously mainstream topic. I tried very hard to make it relatable, tell stories, give examples, et cetera. And I think accomplished that. I don't know, just from the reactions I've gotten, but that is what's more nuanced, is it's more like somebody invented steel and we can make better bridges and buildings versus something that's just like a website you can go to and see it, like ChatGPT.
So what is the first, if this is steel, mm-hmm. what's the first new like suspension bridge or skyscraper that we couldn't have built before?
I think one thing that has been growing faster than people realize, for example, are stablecoins. So stablecoins are, you can put a dollar on a blockchain. There's one called USDC that's very popular. And like last month, as an example, I believe it was $600 billion of stablecoin transactions, and that's been steadily growing. That's mostly happening in the developing world. Your listeners may not be as directly familiar with it, but like countries where there's high volatile currencies has become quite popular. They're using dollars as payments and places to kind of put your money as savings. NFTs, I think of as a way for creative people to sell digital collectibles and backstage passes and other kinds of things to their audiences. NFTs were kind of quote invented in 2020, just to give some context. It's 4-year-old technology, kind of burst on the scene. A lot of people associate it with avatars and maybe have some negative feelings about it because of some of the behavior around it. But fundamentally, it's a very generic technology. I kind of liken it to a website in my book, in that it's just a container of ownership. And that ownership can be a digital picture, but it can also be a membership or a backstage pass, or there's new social networks where it's your handle, it's your name on the social network. And that gives the user the ability to switch software providers if they want to, if they don't like how the social network is behaving. And so there's all sorts of things you can do with NFTs. And NFTs, like, they went up and they drop, but even last year there were $8.6 billion of NFT sales. It's still quite big. So I think the kind of the death of NFTs was overstated and has been coming back. So I think that's important. And that's important because, look, creative people, social networks, and the current economic systems for creative people on the internet are not very good. If you build an audience on most social networks, those social networks make money through advertising, and they don't share that revenue with you, except for very de minimis sub 1% creator funds and things. YouTube is the exception. They share 55% of the revenue with the creators. All the other social networks keep 100% or very close to it. And as a result, you have all of these creators doing things like Substack is one example, where you kind of escape to the freedom of email newsletters. Other people will sell body spray and drinks and sponsorships and do all sorts of gymnastics to make money on the internet, when, in my view, they should just be making money directly from their audience by selling subscriptions and ads and digital collectibles and all sorts of other things. And so NFTs are the first step for enabling that, which I think is very important to allow creative people to make money on the internet. By the way, I'm very pro AI. Our firm invests in AI, but AI will exacerbate this. It's going to make it very cheap to, it already has, to create images and video and text. And creative people in that world need new business models. And that's one of the things you can do with NFT. So that's another one. We have a bunch of interesting things. Like, there's a emerging social network called Farcaster, which is, looks kind of like Twitter at first. It's a couple hundred thousand users right now, growing pretty quickly. The interesting thing about Farcaster is that your identity on the network is an NFT. You own it as a user, which means that there's many different software providers that you can use. And if a software provider, think about if you're on Twitter and they change the rules, they change the algorithm. For example, Twitter has recently been punishing you if you have a link out, and the other social networks have too. If you don't like what they're doing, you can switch software providers while also keeping your audience, very importantly, because you can't leave an existing social network and keep your audience, right? You have to start over. If you go from Twitter to Threads, you have to start over.
Yeah, that portability has been a thing for years,
yes,
right?
So exactly. So that's what Farcaster does. It's portable, and that's really cool and a new thing, and it's gotten software developers really excited. So I would sort of bucket it. There's sort of things that have gotten to scale, like stablecoins and NFTs, and then there's a set of like you said, we have 100 companies. Most of those are very early and haven't launched their products yet or have early products, games, social networks, things, ways for creators to monetize. All the kind of things you do on the internet today, I think you can build better versions of them if you build them on blockchains, is my belief.
You write in the book about this kind of competition is the word, or this duality between the computer, i.e. you describe blockchain as basically this big computer that you can build new stuff with, and the casino, which is like all of the gambling and speculation that goes on around like the emergence of this new technology. And I'm curious about how you think about that, because certainly up until November 2021, the casino was driving interest in the computer because everything was going up. And all of this investment, including you guys and everybody else, were just like finding these interesting companies, pumping lots of money into them. Everybody's getting excited that everybody's launching coins. $3 trillion or whatever the combined market cap was of all these many thousands of coins. And then it all kind of, the music stopped and basically the casino shut down and took everybody's money. But there is a reliance on that casino to keep people building the machine, no? To be building that computer.
So maybe if I could start with that distinction. So let's take Ethereum, which is truly a computer, right? So yeah. Ethereum is a computer that runs as a sort of virtual computer on top of a network of computers. And the way Ethereum works is you can write apps for it, you can write applications for it, but you have to pay to run those apps. And you pay with Ethereum, the native token. That's the purpose of that token, is you pay for it. And in the last 12 months, people paid about $2 billion to run applications on the Ethereum computer. And then the Ethereum computer uses that token in turn to pay people to host the software, essentially. It's called validation, these validators. And so it's sort of this little microeconomy that exists. Yeah. And that's why you need a token, and why a token has purpose, in my opinion, is that you can use it in this little microeconomy that actually has utility. The casino is sort of a set of people who take those tokens that have a purpose and remove them from their context, put them on a website. Often these are offshore Bahamas-based websites and things. And then, you know, all of the kind of financial shilling and other kinds of things you see around things that involve money. By the way, there, just to be clear, like all technologies, there are good, well-designed and badly designed blockchains. I think Ethereum is a very well-designed one. There are bad ones too. And those also get lumped together. I think some of this behavior is just typical of financial markets. So the 90s internet, you had, I think people that didn't live through it might have rose-colored glasses around it. Like, yeah, there was a lot of crap. There was a lot of bad behavior. That said, there was also good stuff, right? And there was money went to productive places and unproductive places. So I think some of it is that. I do think we need better regulation. And we've been calling for this long before FTX. We've been doing it. We've had stuff on our website, position papers, making trips to DC for 5+ years on these topics. So for example, like, there need to be rules. Like if you launch a token, you have certain disclosure requirements, you have lockups, meaning you can't sell the tokens for some period of time. There just need to be rules around it. And there needs to be a pathway to, just without getting too deep in the weeds, there's this whole kind of question of like, is a token a security or a commodity? And most regulators have now said that Bitcoin and probably Ethereum are commodities and therefore classified differently. And so just having those rules be really clear, having a pathway, having guardrails around it. Like this, in my view, is the role of the regulators, of the referees, so to speak, right? We as investors can avoid investing in bad projects, but ultimately we need the regulators and the governments to put rules around it that in my view should allow innovation to occur, because as I've argued in the book, there is a positive purpose to this technology, but also make sure that kind of behavior is minimized or eliminated. Like, look, I certainly venture capital exists, you know, all venture capital, I would say, not just crypto, you know, has this relationship with financial markets that's kind of love hate, to be honest. Like, it's like sometimes we depend on them and need them. And obviously, ultimately, 10 years in or something in our traditional business, companies might IPO and you get liquidity. At the same time, the financial markets, like, they swing backwards as they did in the last 2 years. And that makes it very hard for our companies to operate. So, and I think all of those effects happen here, but maybe they're hypercharged because it's internet and it's 24/7 and all of those things as well. And I think that's just really why you need regulatory guardrails around it.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And how have the last 2 years been for you? Because obviously you guys have billions of dollars to invest. And I was like looking at kind of back in the go-go days, you guys were sometimes doing 4 or 5 investments a month. Sounds totally frenetic. And now it's much more kind of like 1 a month or every 2 months or something like that. Things have slowed down quite a bit. Because also when that was happening 2 years ago, the world was crypto. Everything was going crypto. Everything was going crazy. Valuations were through the roof. And then you have something like, I don't know, OpenSea comes down 99%. And I know that other companies like Amazon had similar drops and then they ended up being Amazon.
Yeah.
But like as an investor, how do you operate in that, in that kind of whipsaw environment?
Yeah. I would say I've been at the firm for almost 11 years, and I was doing non-crypto investing before, and then I was doing angel investing before, and before that I was an entrepreneur. So I've been in this business for 20 plus years. I started my career in the 2003, my first company, and that was a downturn. And then I was an entrepreneur in 2008, and I'll tell you, that was probably the most brutal. That was probably the most brutal in my whole career. Like if you didn't have money as an entrepreneur for that year or two, you were dead.
Basically. What were you doing in 2008? What was your company?
That's when I had an AI startup.
You had an AI startup in 2008?
I did, yeah.
Oh, wow. So that's like double.
I sold it to eBay in 2011. It was a pretty good outcome. And they bought us to do their recommendation system. So sort of the same thing Amazon has. They didn't have the same level of thing. But 2008 was rough. And then, you know, even crypto, but also venture capital didn't have a great 2014. That was a little bit rough. It wasn't a financial crisis. But, you know, these things go in these waves. And then, of course, it's not just OpenSea and crypto. Like the whole growth venture community had a very rough last 2 years. It's just the nature of these things. So, like, tactically, what I've always done is I've learned this, like, when I was involved with Coinbase, especially when you're in an emerging area, you just manage your cash differently. So, like, traditional startups will manage to an 18-month runway. I believe in crypto and all these areas, you manage to a 3 to 4 year runway.
Right.
And so always advise companies to do that. And that's based on the observation that outside of the Great Depression, all financial downturns have lasted 3 to 4 years at most. And that if you have that much kind of those, that many acorns for the winter, you can survive it. So, you know, having been experienced at this, like there are ways to manage through. And like OpenSea, it's the numbers have come back somewhat. It's all public. All the blockchain data is public. I think they're $1.8 billion run rate now, a GMV run rate, gross sales run rate. It definitely dropped, but it's still a considerable business. I invested in Coinbase in 2013, led our investment, and was on the board for a long time. One other thing you learn in this business is that these downturns, if you're with the right company and you manage the cash correctly and you manage the business correctly, it's actually an opportunity for the company to consolidate its market share and get through that. You're right. I mean, like things do slow down. Innovation is fairly consistent. And like you said, we've certainly done investments every month. I think we also did these things like we're doing this crypto startup school. This cohort is in London. That's 25 teams. Sorry, we'll call it Crypto Accelerator. We changed the name. The idea is there's sort of earlier stage companies that we normally get involved with and we help them move along and give them some money. And so we get a little more creative. Look, we spent, just the reality is on my job, in a downturn, you also spend a lot of time just making sure your companies are okay. And so I would say it's a little more in crypto, but this is kind of venture capital, to be honest with you. Like I think of it as like a bullwhip where the public markets is the handle of the bullwhip and the private markets are the end of the whip. Like it's just, this is a magnifying effect of macroeconomic changes to the startup world. You see it in AI now, like you have this cool new demo and then suddenly you're going to have 10,000 AI companies funded. And as like an AI is very powerful and important, but inevitably the market overdoes it. Always does.
Most of them, I think, were going to be revealed as toys that aren't very useful.
Money always gets ahead of reality, like technology, in my view. And so you just have these whipsaw effects and you just have to learn how to manage it.
So in that framing of the history of the internet, And like there was this like explosion of innovation and oh my gosh, this is going to connect the world and all of these things. Mm-hmm. And then it was consolidated into the hands of the big five, let's say. And now here in 2024, perhaps like literally as we speak, emerging from the most recent crypto winter, as we look at what's happening with kind of these crypto prices, et cetera. How do you see this developing? Like if your kind of wildest dreams are realized in terms of the potential of this technology, I guess the question is, for me as a average internet going Joe, how is my life different in 2 years or in 5 years than what it is right now?
So my North Star is not prices. It's new internet services that are used by tens of millions, hundreds of millions, and ultimately billions of people. So I would like to see a world where some number of years from now, I hope it's sooner, but it could take longer, there are credible, for example, social networks and games and creative services, places that you go consume a newsletter or co-create a work on a story or create art or something, all the things you do on the internet. I would love to see a world where there's a credible number of those that are architected in a different way, where the services are owned and operated and controlled by the community and not by these big companies, right? And so a social network, as I described earlier, where you have a choice and you have many different software providers. Think about how you can switch browsers or you can switch email providers. Social networks should work that way. A creator should be able to build an audience. And if they want to run ads or charge for subscription, they should be able to do that. And they should have a direct relationship with the audience the way you do with your email newsletter readers. The readers can leave, but there's no one sitting in the middle between you and your email newsletter readers. That's the way the internet's supposed to work. That could have a very profound consequence because there's this classic blog post Kevin Kelly, the co-founder of Wired, wrote called 1,000 True Fans. The idea was, it's like 2004 he wrote this, and back when we were still optimistic about the internet. And the idea was that the internet would usher in a new era that's not, you no longer need to depend on mass media. So that if you're like an indie musician, in the era of mass media, your dream is to sign with a label and play in a big stadium, right? And you have to do that because that's the economics of mass media. That's the only way you can make a living in that world. The idea with the internet is if you remove all these intermediaries, if you have a direct relationship with your audience, you only need 1,000 true fans. And if you do the math, if 1,000 people pay you $20 a month, that's $20,000 a month. That's a good living for, you know, and then you can go and I can have some extremely niche interest and find 1,000 people and not have to sell out and not have to compromise my values and not have to go and chase the latest trends. And on the flip side, by like the consumption experience, like you look at the consumption experience now on social media and it's this constant dopamine feed on the algorithms and it's these for-profit companies trying to, you know, milk out another moment of attention. And instead, it's deep, authentic engagement. This is what the internet was supposed to do for the creative world and it should have done. And I think a lot of people think that somehow the internet just didn't live up to its promise. I view it as it took a wrong turn. It took a wrong turn and handed power to these five companies and we can still fix it, right? That's where I think a lot of people would agree with my negative premise that the internet didn't live up to its potential. So if you talk to like Tristan Harris or one of these kinds of internet skeptics, I actually agree with a lot of his criticisms. Where I disagree is I don't think it's over. It's a function of the fact that the internet going wrong is closely connected with the fact that we architected it such that it benefited consolidation and concentration. And that there is a possible way to fix it. So I view it as we agree on the problem, but maybe disagree on the solution, or at least, and I'm not saying this is guaranteed, but I think it's a very promising path to explore for entrepreneurs. And so that would be my vision, is that you'd end up with an internet that's like the 90s internet in its vision and ideals, but like the modern internet in its advanced functionality, because of course people aren't going to go backwards on the user experience and all the other things. There are a lot of wonderful things about the current internet. It's very easy to use. Look, I'm looking at you now, you're across the country and we're high-speed video and all of these great creator tools and AI, and these are all great things and we should embrace them. But I believe we don't have to embrace them and compromise what the internet should be great for, which is letting people build direct audiences and find careers and be creative. And I think these things really just become urgent in the AI era, because now the remaining business models of putting something online and relying on search to send you traffic, it's all going to go away. You're going to have five AI systems that give you answers, that produce video, that produce art, that produce writing.
And I think we have a real fork in the road between this kind of world of these five internet services and kind of nothing else, or a diverse, rich, interesting, decentralized internet. And my argument is a lot of it comes down to how we build these internet services.
I was just doing a piece this week on Google in the wake of its kind of Gemini fiasco and its attempts to kind of, you know, it's the classic innovator's dilemma. They've got this like monopoly that they have to effectively disrupt if they want to stay relevant. But inertia is really a powerful thing. And I was thinking about just me, my internet habits, like everybody else, I go to Google when I'm searching for something, but I've just started dabbling with like something like Perplexity, which I don't know if you've used, but it's one of these early tools where it's like you ask it a question, it gives you an answer. It's not the blue links. It's not the Google model, and it's actually pretty good. And you can start to see like the outline of like, oh, actually, this is just going to get better. And it's going to obviate a Google-like service at some point for a lot of queries. But the reason is because it's really good and it just works. And so I guess the question is for this blockchain stuff, like, how do you work against that inertia? How do you shake people loose from these systems that are very powerful and very easy to use? When my experience of crypto was like, do I need a MetaMask wallet? Do I need to do this? It's not very user friendly.
Like I argue this in the book, like the blockchain stuff has to be feature parity, I call it, with the other stuff. Like it's just simply not acceptable. And that's a tech problem that is being solved. You mentioned our portfolio companies, like a significant number of them are kind of at the quote infrastructure side. So fixing that. So I do think that like just the sheer user experience will get there.
That's like just an engineering and design issue.
Yeah,
try
out Farcaster. It's pretty close to a Twitter. It's a social network. So I guess I would say there's the sort of the things that are predictable, and like that will happen. Like we will get user experiences that are competitive. The harder problem is that a lot of these benefits are subtler, right? Yeah. The fact that the economic benefit is that you can create a direct relationship with your audience. Like it takes time to understand that and to build that out. And so that is actually in some ways the harder problem, right? Is that a lot of these corporate networks like Google, let's say, one of my core arguments is that they sort of a little bit play this bait and switch game. So when Google started off, there were no ads on the page.
Yeah.
It was all pure links. It worked incredibly well. And then as you notice, like
it's the yellow pages now.
You go to mobile search a lot of times now and the entire first page will be either Google properties or ads, right? And so what they do is they play this game where they hook you. And social networks, by the way, when they started off, they were all really open to outside developers. Like Facebook had Zynga and Twitter had all these Twitter clients and all these people building other tools around it. And they didn't have ads and they let users do whatever they wanted and have links and things. And then over time, like they started cracking down on the developers. They started adding more ads. They started restricting what you can do in your tweets in terms of linking out and all these other things. And so what they do is a little bit of this kind of, I call it the attract extract cycle. I argue that it's inevitable with these services that they all, Amazon, more and more, have you noticed this? More and more of the results are ads.
Yep.
So it's hard to find recommendations that aren't sponsored now.
I think it's $30 billion a year in ads that they're bringing in now, which is just extraordinary.
And why do they do it? I argue that this is the core logic of these companies, because what happens is, look, you raise money from people like us, right? Then you go public. And if you go to Google, right, like the entire Google system, including the option grants they give to employees, right, everything is based on the stock price.
Correct.
You talk to the employees there, and the vast majority of their compensation is stock price, right? And the stock price, you go read the Wall Street reports, it's all predicated on Google growing 20% a year. But the organic growth of Google is not 20% a year. That is why they keep squeezing more juice out of the rock.
Yeah.
Right? So if they grow 10% a year and Wall Street wants them to grow 20% a year, they got to put some more ads on the page, right? And that's what's happening with all of these companies. What I would argue is over time, I believe internet users start to get savvier about these things. And they start to say, I would hope, and say, sure, this new internet service seems awesome today, but what am I signing up for? What is this going to be 10 years from now? And maybe I need to be more discerning and not, instead of relying on a 30-page terms of service and privacy policy and just sort of blindly trusting this management team, maybe I'm going to demand that I actually know what my internet service I'm committing to. And that's exactly a blockchain I call in the book, a computer that can make commitments. It's a computer that can, you can design an internet service and you can encode in the actual software what the rules of the service are and will forever be. And so you can build a search engine or a social network, and you can say, this is how much we're going to charge. Here are the rules for developers. Here are the rules for the users. Here are the rules for the creators. And they can never change. It doesn't matter if the founder of the project or the creator changes their mind later, because it's encoded in the blockchain. That's the special feature about a blockchain, is that you can encode rules in it that can't change. I call it can't be evil instead of don't be evil. Google's right. original motto is don't be evil.
Yeah, yeah.
The problem with don't be evil is the founders leave at some point. And that the logic
they dropped that in 2015, in fact.
Yeah, and I'm not saying they're evil, but I'm just saying at some point the logic of the company takes over. What are you going to do if you're the CEO? You're not going to maximize profits. Some corporate raider will take you over, right? Like it's just the logic of the system. But it ends up hurting the user. I was doing that kind of investing, like Web2 investing, whatever you want to call investing in these companies. And at some point, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, I was like, I can't do this anymore, because I've seen it. Everyone in the business knows this happens. It's bait and switch. It's not a secret. I'm just one of the first ones to put it in a book. But it's pretty obvious this is what all these guys do, because of course, it's just the only way you know, fundamentally you're going to make a business is you start off trying to get everyone to use it and being as nice as possible. And then eventually you try to squeeze them for the revenue, right? And I decided I'm opting out of that. Is my view.
But it sounds like, I mean, that's like an indictment of kind of capitalism.
Well, you could argue that. But I mean, look, what a blockchain is, it just sort of says, like, don't trust the system, trust the code, in the same way open source software does.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I was talking to a policymaker recently, and she said, she's like, I just don't trust you tech people anymore. Now you're telling me that you're doing blockchains, and like everything that tech people ever said never worked. And I said, there's one big exception to that, and it's open source software. And she actually, it was interesting. She was like, that's actually true. And I was like, and that's why you should like blockchains, because blockchains, you don't have to trust me. It's open source code, and it's only the code. I can be the worst person in the world, but a well-designed blockchain, you can know what it's going to do based on the code. And so this is actually, if you don't trust tech people, this is exactly why you should like blockchains, because it's like open source, and that it's saying, trust the code, not the people.
And do you have a sense of what the wedge is for blockchain? If we're talking about these big internet services, again, just like that idea of inertia, which I'm increasingly awed by, especially when you look at something like Facebook that has had all of these issues. Just the other day, I was meeting with one of the whistleblowers who testified in Congress about all the harm to kids and stuff. And like, it doesn't matter. It gets more and more people, because once you have that network effect, like you can, or same thing with Google, you can completely corrupt and pollute the core of your product and people still use it day in and day out. And so it feels like you have to come up with something that is so mind-blowingly new or better in such a clear and obviously understandable way. That feels like the challenge for all of this stuff in the blockchain world, and I have yet to see it. And to the contrary, most of this stuff is like, it's not obvious to me.
Look, I think your point about inertia is a good one. And just to add to it, Microsoft Excel has been around for God knows how long. And there have been 10,000 startups that have tried to replace it. And as far as I know, Excel is still probably the most popular software in the world.
Yep.
That said, look, if you look at the last 30 years of the internet, what's happened is Excel's there, but then you layer on a new service and you layer on a new, and you sort of have ever expanding circles. And computing just becomes a bigger and bigger part of our lives. It ends up probably less competing with new internet services, probably honestly don't compete as much with existing internet services they do with non-internet businesses. So like AI is probably going to have a bigger effect on Hollywood than on Google, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe both. And so I think a similar thing, like I just fundamentally believe like the internet will become more and more important in our lives, and you'll have AI, you'll have like, it's a jargony word, but I think metaverse and VR and all these things will also happen. I think robotics and self-driving cars, and just computers will become more and more embedded in our lives, more and more time spent, more and more immersive, and there'll be many new services created. So even if you're right that there's so much inertia with existing services, I think there'll be, you know, we're 30 years into the internet, which, you know, it sounds hyperbolic, but I think is credibly as important as something like the printing press.
Yep.
And 30 years in, there's a lot more to do. And so then to me, the question is, how do we build those services? What is the architecture behind those services? Do we build them with wood or with steel? So I think there's, in that sense, if you look at it from kind of zoom out, bigger picture, even with the inertia you talk about, which I think is valid, I think there's still many opportunities to build new internet services using blockchains.
You talk about Ethereum as kind of this computer upon which you can build apps versus Bitcoin. Do you see Bitcoin as this thing over there, which is
kind of, yeah,
digital gold as a kind of basically store of value slash speculative tool that people can bet on, and then everything else?
Kind of. I mean, there's some nuance, which is that there are people trying to build. There's something called Lightning, which is a payment system on top of Bitcoin. There's other things around it. So there are a few exceptions. I mean, it's software is sort of complicated and very malleable and plastic. But generally, yes. Generally, like what happened, just for those who want to know, is that there was sort of a civil war in the Bitcoin community 2017. Think of it as, do we want to be money or tech?
Yeah.
And they chose to be money, and the tech people left and did things like Ethereum and Solana. And if you go to, I'm about to go to ETH Denver, which is the big Ethereum conference this year. And it's just a bunch of, it's, you might as well be at an open source conference or something.
Yeah.
They're all technologists who really just care about software, and you'll hear very little talk about money. And then you go to a Bitcoin Miami conference and it's all about money. I'm not saying that's bad or wrong, but it's not my crowd, and it's not, it's just very different, just different cultures. And like, yeah, but I think what happens is people lump them together from the outside and they think all crypto is about money, but there's actually this other world of, and that's what I try and talk about in the book, of blockchain people. And again, like there are tokens, and but they play a purpose. Like they're kind of the fuel for a microeconomy that helps you power these services. But there's very little focus on money in and of itself. It's much more kind of tech and software focused. And I'm in that world. I'm very much in the sort of Ethereum, yeah, tech world.
Just a question on regulation and or kind of the state role, the potential for kind of central bank digital currencies, et cetera. Central bank digital currencies is one question. And the other one is just regulation, right? You've just had the launch of these ETFs, which has seen a bunch of money rush into Bitcoin, it seems. But just trying to understand how you view that, it seems like that is an injection of legitimacy to this thing that a lot of people, like, you know, Warren Buffett calls it, what do you call it? Rat poison
rat
squared.
Poison, yeah.
But just trying to understand how you view the government's evolving view of the sector and, yeah, how that fits with the overall thesis.
I mean, yes, a couple things. So the central bank digital currency, like I would argue that we have that, which is stablecoin. So there's a stablecoin called USDC that's very popular, you know, hundreds of billions of transactions a month. It's built on top of Ethereum. There's a bill, a stablecoin bill in front of Congress that would put some guardrails around it. You can have a stablecoin, but it has to be audited. You have to follow anti-money laundering rules, et cetera. I would argue that sort of a private-public partnership is the best way to approach things like a digital dollar, which is to have the private sector is generally good at building the technology, but you need the government to regulate that. And I would argue that's better than the alternative, which is like the government actually builds the software. But that's going to be a big debate politically, yeah, I think, over the next few years. It's just like who controls that and who builds that. I think that any kind of things like the ETF do help with legitimacy. A lot of people in DC, when I was going there last year, for them, crypto just kind of began in 2021 because they weren't paying attention to the kind of earlier stuff. And then you had these scandals, and then they assumed it would go away. That was a very common refrain,
right,
in 2022 and 2023,
right,
that it was sort of this thing. It was a zero interest rate phenomenon, and now it's gone, right? And now we can just kind of like have a few court cases and just it'll go away. And I think that people are realizing it's more than that, that there's this pretty big movement. I mean, there's 50 million Americans have crypto, but it's a smaller group, but still significant. Hundreds of thousands are like me, are like enthusiasts, building software, investing in software. And it's a significant movement, and it's not going away. Like you'd mentioned that Bitcoin started in 2008. Like the negative case is, hey, it's been a long time. Where are the apps? The,
yeah,
positive case is it's been a long time. It doesn't just seem like a short-term bubble. Like there's, yeah, a lot of true believers who really believe in this stuff, right? And they are here, and they're not going away. And so I do think that there's now kind of a little bit of a growing realization among kind of the establishment regulators that, hey, let's not just assume this will go away. Let's come up with an intelligent way to regulate it. And that's what we've been arguing for, is like, it's not going away. It's a real thing. Let's figure out a way to maximize the good and minimize the bad. And I do think we're trending that way. It's not there yet, but I believe that will be the eventual outcome. There will be, of course, need to be guardrails and rules, and you need to first and foremost protect consumers, but there will be legal kind of acceptable ways to build these things. And so I think the ETF and all these things, they're sort of all steps in that direction.
Right.
It's happening, but it just takes time for kind of these things to change and for government to take action.
Have you talked to Warren Buffett about this?
I have not. He doesn't seem to be a fan. Like, I think a lot of folks like Warren Buffett, as far as I can tell, he's really talking about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
He doesn't say Bitcoin, obviously, all the time, but it's very hard to read a lot of those negative statements and think that they're talking about, that they've really kind of understood the nuances between Ethereum and Bitcoin. Because, like, for example, a very common thing you'll hear is there's no cash flow. Ethereum has cash flow.
Right.
It's a productive asset that generated $2 billion in revenue last year. And so I just assume when I read some of these things that they just are talking about Bitcoin, essentially, and that sort of become, in the vernacular, that sort of becomes synonymous with crypto. In fact, the reality is software is a very plastic medium, very malleable medium, and any economic system you can imagine, you can design in software, and people have. And so that, as a result, there are bad economic systems and good ones, and you need to just sort of look at the details. And that's one of the things I try to do in the book, is just sort of walk through how some of the good ones and bad ones work and just explain it. It's still a reasonable position to say, okay, Ethereum is a productive asset. It does have cash flow. It does have a rational kind of way to value it. That said, I don't like it. I'm not interested in it. I'm not excited by it. That's fine. But the criticism that it's just a meme coin, a magic beans, rat poison, I don't think that is a criticism that it doesn't seem to me those folks have actually done the work on those and understood some of the better design systems.
Just lastly on that, $2 billion generated by Ethereum, that $2 billion is, who does that go to? Where is that flowing?
That goes to the system. So that's, as I checked 2 weeks ago or something, so I don't know what the latest numbers are, but that is gas fees. So it's called gas.
Gotcha.
Gas fees are when you run applications, it's like an old style mainframe system.
Yeah.
You pay to use a system. And it was something in that rough order of, let's call it roughly $2 billion, because I don't know the exact numbers, but it goes to the system. It goes to the blockchain.
Right.
And then the blockchain kind of divvies that money out to the, what are called validators, who are the people that actually host the software. Because remember, these are hosted services.
Yeah.
Someone has to run the hosting software, right? Just like when you host a website, somebody has to pay for that.
Right. And everybody was moaning about gas fees for...
Yeah. Yeah. They go up and down. And actually there's a lot, like there's a big improvement to Ethereum kind of happening in 2 weeks, which will lower them like by 10x, hopefully, for certain use cases.
Well, look, I appreciate you taking the time and I wish you luck. Anybody I talk to in crypto, it feels like I think of Sisyphus.
it's a little Sisyphusian.
And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Chris for taking the time. I want to thank you all for listening, for the ratings, for the reviews, for spreading the word. I know I say it every time, but it really does help. I will not be writing about crypto this week. I've got another big project cooking, which you will be seeing shortly, so keep your eyes peeled for that. But do check out what's happening at thetimes.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at Danny Fortson. And that is it for me this week. I will be back next week with another episode for your delectation. In the meantime, have a fantastic week, and we'll talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.